Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website, kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show's called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. My guest today is Bob Wheeler, who has been guiding the much-talked-about Hadlock sewer system for the past couple of years. Just in case you're new to town or have been asleep for the past 20 or 30 years, the sewer system in Port Hadlock is something that has been planned or at least dreamed about for decades now, but it's finally happening. Completion of the system will dramatically change the housing situation on the peninsula. Bob will tell us why in just a few minutes. But first, as usual, we want to devote a few minutes to getting to know the man who has played such a pivotal role. So, Bob, let's talk a little bit about you. Are you a local boy born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
First, I want to say thank you for having me. And this is, I think, a second time
yes,
to talk a little bit about
repeat
this project. And I am not a local. I've been here since 1990, and I came as public works director for the city of Port Townsend for about 10 years.
Okay, so where were you born?
I was born in Huntington, New York, which is near New York City.
Okay.
And grew up there for all my 18 years, one town and one school system.
And what'd your folks do?
My dad was an engineer. He did a variety of things. Partly, it was running a dye house in Brooklyn, New York. Which dyed clothing. When he liquidated that in the 60s, he became a stockbroker and then a building and ground superintendent for a school district. My mom was traditional of that era of being an at-home mom. So she had a full-time job doing that and was very active in environmental issues. And
a bit ahead of her time.
A little bit ahead of her time in terms of environmental stuff.
Okay.
Yep.
I always like to spend at least a minute or two asking about people's high school years because they're so pivotal. What do you think the other kids thought of you, not what you thought of yourself?
I was very active in school. I actually liked high school. That was probably unusual at that day and era. I had some unbelievably great teachers, mentors that I had. And I think that because I was in the band playing trombone, I was in several sports. I played in a group that played for plays and that type of thing. And it was Key Club and a number of different types of things. So I had a wide range of friends. I wasn't in any one clique. And I think I was well-liked during those ages.
And in your household, were you guys sort of expected to go on to university?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
It was definitely on the radar. And were you encouraged to go to any particular spot, or do you have anything in mind?
Well, about 13 people in my family went to University of Michigan, but that was not an expectation. But my dad was very clear. He wanted me to go to college and insisted I would go to college, but he also insisted I do something that would have value coming out, whatever that might be, that I could get a job.
Okay.
And so I chose engineering and largely environmental engineering, even though in the dark ages when I went to college, it was civil engineering. So I had a more general background in engineering.
But it was an area you were interested in.
It was. I was very active, loved the outdoors, did a lot of outdoor stuff and hiking and canoeing and things like that. So the environment became very important to me, probably because of my mom's influence, frankly.
And so where were you at university?
I went to University of New Hampshire in Durham, New Hampshire.
And did you get an advanced degree as well?
I did. I graduated in 1974 from college with a Bachelor's of Science in Civil Engineering, and I didn't quite feel that I was ready to just jump out there. For one thing, I had a beard, and a lot of the jobs that engineering firms were offering, a beard would not have been acceptable and things like that. It was quite a different age and time. And so I went on and got my master's and started my first job out of college, really. Even though I hadn't finished my master's, I did finish it eventually, but was with the Regional Planning Commission dealing with basically an area and how they should deal with wastewater issues that were of concern.
Was that in New Hampshire?
It was in New Hampshire, Southern Rockingham Regional Planning Commission.
Okay.
So
And that was your first sort of full-time big boy job?
Yep, full-time big boy job, working as an engineer for that group.
And did you stay with them a long time?
I knew going into it that it was a three-year position, and that was great from my standpoint. So I worked for 3 years helping with that plan together, and then traveled in Europe. In that day and age, Europe was a big place to be going to. So I was over there bicycling for some of that just on my own with a partner, and then just traveled for at least 4 months, and then came back and ended up in Idaho working with Division of Environment with the State Department in Idaho.
And how long did you stay in Idaho?
I was there 3 years. I had these three-year cycles, and then I went to 10-year cycles. So I was there for 3 years and got an offer and applied for and got an offer with the city of Boulder, Colorado, which most people would say was not a bad spot to go to.
Nice
it was
spot.
A really great spot, and became coordinator of treatment operations initially, and then ultimately utilities director. So everything dealing with water, water rights, stormwater, wastewater, and a little bit of hydroelectric.
So it all flowed together.
It did all flow together, yes.
Okay. And so you were in Boulder for 10 years.
10 years.
And what prompted the next change?
Well, I had been there 10 years. I ended up with twins, one with Down syndrome. And as great as Boulder was in the Front Range, it just seemed like I was going to end up not having a lot of opportunities for promotion. The public works director, who was my boss, was pretty set there, and he was fine as a supervisor. But I just thought maybe it's time to check out something else. And because I had done a bicycle trip through the Pacific Northwest, including on the ferry coming on into Port Townsend, and I vividly remember Port Townsend from that bike trip in, I think it was 1974, I ended up thinking, maybe the Northwest is the place to go. And I knew this was the rain shadow, and there was in one of my journals an advertisement for public works director here. So I came to Port Townsend as the public works director, and I'd been hired for that.
And so that was in 1984?
Up to 1990 that I came here, says public works director, and I was public works director through 2000.
Okay. So you were a decade with the city of Port Townsend, basically.
Yes.
And what, over that period of time, what did you basically do? I know you can't encapsulate 10 years in 2 minutes, but give it a shot.
Well, first off, it's a very, very active community. I was very actively involved with the public with me and with Public Works. I was responsible for water, wastewater, stormwater, also water rights issues, transportation. We did the non-motorized plan back then, which actually has resulted in all these great trails. That was sort of the start of really getting a focus on putting in trails, and included a funding source at that point in time. Fleet, facilities, City Dock, Union Wharf were both projects that I was involved with. The wastewater treatment plant, voiding filtration at that point in time, and also buying a lot of land, including in the Quimper Wildlife Corridor, which was helping start that off, I think, at that point in time in the early 90s. So a lot of varied types of things that I got to work on.
Oh, a lot of our listeners might not realize that Port Townsend did not really have much of a water purification system at all. Can you tell us what the story was?
So on the water side, we were unfiltered water supply, surface water supply from the Big Quilcene and Little Quilcene rivers. There was a mascot in the state across the nation actually called Giardia, and then started in Cryptosporidium, which is a parasitic type of organism that you really needed to put in filtration if you had a surface water supply. But there was a tiny ability to avoid filtration. And because we were working so much on the wastewater sides of things, I worked hard to try to avoid filtration, so that at the point in time we'd need to have filtration, we'd be a few years down the road. And they have a filtration plant now. On some of the land that we actually purchased back then, just to preserve some land for that treatment plant for the water side.
A lot of delay in getting the filtration system, and it didn't make certain people happy. Certain people did want to have it filtered.
They did not, and there was concerns about that. But from what my knowledge is and the type of treatment they ultimately put in, there's not been any complaints about water quality or anything like that. And, you know, the city is removing organisms that could be of concern. There was a campground at 100 to 300 feet above where our intake was in the Big Quill Scene River, where people were there. There was no toilets there. So it was important for us.
Yeah.
You know, it's a public use
You know, I mean, it's all working now, and it's great. Port Townsend was sort of a laggard getting into the filtration. And there was some pressure from, was it the state or was it the feds?
So on the wastewater side, there definitely was some concern. So when I got here, we just had a primary wastewater treatment plant, basically removed the big solids and out it goes into the Puget Sound, similar to what Victoria was doing at that point in time. And it was clear the state was going to require us to filter, provide a wastewater treatment process to treat our wastewater before it got discharged out to Puget Sound. And so that's what we did do a lot. There was a group called Sensible Sewage Solutions that actually had concerns about what the city was doing. And we worked hard with them and came to, I think, a great agreement. I think they'd agree with that too. As a matter of fact, they gave about $100 of their war chest against the city for landscaping at the end. And we celebrated the opening of this wastewater treatment plant, which most people hardly see. It's out on Kuhn Street and it's very well camouflaged. We had raft races in the oxidation ditches as a celebration.
I remember that.
For the grand opening.
You have some pictures of that, don't you?
We do. I do have some, yeah.
That's pretty funny. Okay, so you were with the city until the year 2000, roughly.
2000, yeah.
And what happened? When did you decide to leave?
Well, there was quite a political change, and I'd been a change agent. And so I decided that I'd probably would move on. It just seemed like the right time to do that. And I got a job with a firm called Triangle Associates, which was out of Seattle, was eventually president of that for about 8 years, worked with them a total of about 20 years. And it was a facilitation public outreach type of firm. And I got to work on some of the most amazing projects, air tours over national parks with the FAA and National Park Service, a lot on endangered species, steelhead. And actually, I just noticed that they're implementing some of the things we talked about on Hood Canal Bridge that blocks salmon and steelhead coming through that bridge when their young ones fry. And they're putting in some types of structures to help them maneuver around that big dam, that's a dam to them. So there's an implementation of one of the projects that I was working on,
which
was the recovery plan itself. And that was some of what was in there.
Didn't realize. Also, I didn't realize there were air tours over the national parks.
Oh, yes.
Yeah? Where do you find out about those?
Well, if you go to Grand Canyon, there are a huge number of helicopters.
Yeah, no, I've heard of that, but out here, are there things that go over there?
Well, this was nationwide I was working on it. So I actually had meetings in Biscayne Bay National Park. The plan was overall, it was a congressional law that said you form a National Park Overflight Advisory Committee. And I was facilitating that group and trying to come together with air tour operators and environmental interests and tribal interests to see if it could be figured out how tours could be controlled a little bit more than they were, and not just sort of the Wild West that anybody could fly any place they wanted to.
Yeah, well, I've certainly heard of it in the Grand Canyon and certain places like that. I just jumped to the conclusion there were some close by, but I guess that's not true.
Olympic National Park and actually Rainier, neither of those parks have a lot of them. Where you'll find them a lot more is down in the Southwest, especially Rainbow Bridge, and actually got involved in that one a little more even in detail, where the tribe were very worried even about vibrations from helicopters flying in this canyon and potentially affecting the structural integrity of the bridge. And there was eagle's nests that they wanted to not have flights going over a certain direction. And so, you know, it was very fascinating type of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And at some point you decided to leave the Triangle.
I'm old. I'm getting old. And so it was time to retire. I'd been there 20 years. one of the projects I had worked on was through a consultant engineering firm on Port Hadlock sewer, and I just decided that I would kind of keep my hand in that if the county needed help as a consultant. It was time to move on, and we had new owners that bought us out, some of us oldsters. I retired, only to get a call from the county saying, hey, from Monty Reinders, who's the public works director, I cannot do this project on my own. I have a full-time job, and I'm trying to pull this project off. Is there any way you could come and work part-time for the county and help me try to get this sewer project going
and so implemented? When did you come on board for that?
So it was, I think it was the fall of 2020. Yeah, fall of 2020.
So you've been working on the project ever since.
Now, I have.
I know that you were on this show about a year ago, roughly speaking, and you'd made a fair amount of progress, but I know that you've made some giant steps in the interim. And in fact, the group has just brought in Sam Harper from PUD, and she's going to officially be the project manager, which unofficially you have been, but you know, let's call you senior consultant. You also have another key hire, John Black, who's an engineer, right?
Correct.
Let's just take this in two stages. Flashback to a year ago. Where were we on it? And then let's talk about what's happened since then.
Well, a year ago, we were working a lot on the design of this system, which includes a treatment plant. It's going to produce Class A water, which is very high quality water that can be reused. We were going to construct a percolation pond that would allow water to drain into groundwater, eventually have some amount of recharge to Chimacum Creek. And then because of costs, we really looked this through and decided we'd go with a grinder pump and pressure sewer type of system. So each property will have a tank and a grinder pump underground, electrical connection, and sewage coming out of any structure or building will be intercepted from going to the septic tank leach field system they have or whatever system they might have on site. Come on over to this tank, and it's then pushed by these grinder pumps into the pressure sewer system. And those are the pump stations that essentially pump it all the way to the wastewater treatment plant.
Okay. I'm not sure most of our listeners are aware of this. Port Townsend has had a sewer system since the late 1800s, when there was this frenzy of building because it was going to be the key port city, et cetera, et cetera. However, the Hadlock area did not get a sewer system. And up until now, everyone basically is on septic. And that imposes a lot of limitations on what you can do. Right now, the land use is such that it's basically roughly one structure, one, let's call it a house, per 5 acres, which doesn't do much for density or affordable housing. Now, the sewer system, when it comes in, is going to make a vast change here.
It will.
And another intriguing thing that you said last year was that you had decided, well, your group had decided to divide the projects into more manageable size contracts so local firms could have a shot rather than make it one huge $35 million project, which is roughly what it's going to be. You've broken it up a bit. So how has that worked?
It's worked great so far, and I think it'll continue to work great. So a couple of things. What we're calling the phase one area, which is basically the commercial core. It includes the elementary school, the library, all the way down to the waterfront, the Northwest School wooden boat building, and then down Chimacum Road, those areas. And so what we've really been doing is looking seriously at how we're going to sewer that area. The really good news, and in answer to your first question a bit ago, where were we a year ago? I mean, we had nowhere near the funds that we have now. Right now, we have over $35 million of funding from Senator Murray, Representative Kilmer, from an ecology grant that's $5 million with a loan, a 0.4% interest rate, $1.67 million loan that comes with that $5 million. And we have this $20 million that we got from the state legislature, thanks a lot to Steve Theringer's leadership. And then we have some match monies that the county has to put on into this project. So with $35 million, we are now able to go ahead and really work on this project. And you're correct in that that whole area is on septic tank leach field systems. And because of that, through Growth Management Act requirements, you have to be at rural zoning, even though that area multiple years ago was declared an urban growth area. Maybe the best example is with Habitat for Humanity.
Yes.
They bought 17 acres of property that is called the old airport property. It's in back of the school and the library. Right now, with the zoning that exists being rural, they could build about 3 homes out there. And they bought that with the expectation sewer was going to happen and is right. going to happen. And they are looking at between 120 and 200 units of housing there that will be a mix of housing, low income for sure, with some middle income, I think, is what they're right. thinking about. So that gives you an example of, in, from a housing standpoint, what can happen. And there's a lot of vacant area in that core area that we're talking about, this phase one area that will be able to be developed for housing or, depending on the zoning, commercial.
Some of the businesses out there must be pretty excited about the concept, like QFC, for example.
You talk to anybody that uses that QFC and they say there's no parking, it's crowded, it's way overused for the size of that store and the parking available. And from what I know, they're seriously looking at what expansion they will be able to do to really upsize that whole store and situation there. And then there's other properties, too, that I think we'll be able to develop, both from a housing standpoint, but also from economic development standpoint.
Okay, but at this stage, we're not just designing and thinking about it. We're actually digging things, right?
You are right. And so this gets at your question that I didn't answer yet, which is how we're phasing it. So a $35 million project, if we were just to bid one project, $35 million, a lot of our local contractors would not have a chance to be able to bid on that type of project. So what we've done is broken this out. So the first part of this project that we have bid, local contractor, is what we were hoping for. Seton Construction has had the low bid. The price from our standpoint came in an excellent amount for us, lower than we were expecting. And so that's going to start off on grading and site work on the inlet pipeline, the percolation pond, you getting utilities to the site and that type of thing. We hope to bid then the treatment plant, which will be a little bit bigger and may or may not be local contractors, but it'll be, you know, kind of a medium-sized type of project when you look at the region. And then we'll bid out separately the collection system and then individual on-site grinder pump work and that type of thing. So that's how we're going. And our hopes are that we will generate a lot of interest in our local contractor community for a lot of these different jobs that we're looking at and contracts that we're looking at.
So right now, today, what's happening physically?
So today, physically, the first contract hasn't started. June 16th is start date on actually breaking ground. We'll probably do some sort of celebration of breaking ground, but not at the beginning. I think we need to look at some unique ways to celebrate, maybe or maybe not. It'll be the golden shovel that is the tradition when you start a construction project, but maybe we can have some fun with this. So we might do that in August after construction started a little bit so people can see that. And so that'll be a big thing. And then I've been working a lot on sewer ordinance and rates and our policies on who will be required to hook up, who can volunteer to hook up, and what incentives we're going to give for people hooking up to the system.
Yeah, because all of these people, whether it's businesses or private homes, they all have septic systems that presumably are working, and they paid for them. So what's going to happen, and what's their incentive to switch?
Well, one incentive is that all of a sudden their property becomes much more valuable and usable by them. So they can go to the basically urban zoning will come into effect when the sewer is in there. And so they will be able to develop at a much greater density, both housing and businesses, that type of thing. So that's one advantage that they'll have. And then we're looking at incentives and, what we're really talking about is that we would construct the on-site and pay for the on-site work. That's preliminarily where we're sitting right at this point in time. We kind of have to see how this money gets distributed out.
Okay. And what happens to the old septic system? They don't pull them out, do they?
Well, part of our project will be to abandon the septic tanks, right, which is that you pump them out and then you fill them with material and you break some holes in them so they're not holding water and that type of thing. The leach field systems can stay in place. The septic tanks can stay in place unless somebody is thinking of building something that they would be in the way.
If you wanted to put an apartment house there, you might have to
pull up the pipes in the leach field, and that's something we would not be doing. But we are seriously looking at how we could go ahead and actually fully abandon it in terms of the requirements of the Environmental Public Health Department. So,
I guess you have to be really careful about it. I've never lived in a property with septic, but I have many friends who have, and I know there's a lot to consider about the whole thing.
There is, and certainly in terms of operation, and the reality for everybody in the UGA out there, urban growth area, is that they cannot go to an urban level of development. And I think a lot of the businesses and housing groups are really excited about having the sewer in because they will be able to have major expansions.
Yeah, well, I recently had the director of Habitat on the show, and she is very excited about what they might be able to do with their 17 acres out there. Now,
and we're in good touch with her, too. We've been working a lot with Habitat for Humanity, so it's a good partnership.
Okay, so here is a real difficult question when it comes to construction. When do you think it's going to be done and operational?
Okay. We're starting right now, basically June 16th. We're going to start on the construction. We hope to bid the wastewater treatment system itself in the September-October time period. We have already bid what are called membrane bioreactors, MBRs for short, which are a big part of this treatment system, and they're manufactured elsewhere, brought in on a truck and dropped in place. And then the collection system and then individual properties, we're really aiming for sometime in 2025 for to be operational.
Well, and that will be our final word for today because we're basically out of time. So, folks, you heard him. He's saying sometime in 2025, at least the core part of the Hadlock sewer system will be operating. But there's obviously a ways to go. So, Bob, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today has been Bob Wheeler, the man who's been guiding the Hadlock sewer system for several years now and is very excited about moving ahead. In addition to thanking Bob, I also want to thank our editor and producer, Sonny Flores. Many of you don't realize how much an editor contributes to the show. He makes us sound so much better and takes out our mistakes and mumbles and jumbles and everything. In addition to thanking Bob, I want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with KPTZ during our first 12 years. What a ride it has been, particularly with that little thing called COVID. So, listener, stay healthy, stay safe, and keep listening to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Marianne McNellis and edited by Sonny Flores.